Parsha B'Shalach, certainly the opening section, is dominated clearly by the events of Kriyas Yamsuf, the splitting of the Red Sea, and Oz Yashir, the song at the sea. And there is a group of psukim, say a triumvirate of psukim, that are part of the lead up to Kriyas Yamsuf, and I would like to take a look at them. They are, one could say, psukim that one might skip over in recounting the events, but as we will see, there's great significance, of course, to them, and that is in Perek Yud Dalet, psukim Yud Tes Tekaf Aleph. Yud Tes Tekaf Aleph, and we'll read them together just to refresh our familiarity with them, and then see what the Mefarshim discuss. Pasuk Yud Tes. So the Jewish people are about to move forward towards the Yam Suf, and as a prelude to that, Pasuk Yud Tes reads: Vayisa Malach Elokim Haholech Lifnei Machane Yisrael Vayelech Miachareihem. The angel of Hashem, who was until that point going before the people, moves to go behind them. And a second development, Vayisa Amud He'anan Mipnehem, Vayamud Me'acharehem. The cloud that would normally go before them also goes behind them. And this is actually quite interesting because, as Mefarshim point out, they were led by a cloud during the day. At night, it was a pillar of fire. This is already nighttime, and still the cloud is there. For on this occasion, it stayed, and it moves also behind them. That's the first pasuk. So the angel moves from in front of them to behind them. The cloud moves from in front of them to behind them. Next, pasuk kaf, vayavo ben machane Mitzrayim uvein machane Yisrael. It comes between the two camps, these the malach and the cloud. So you had cloud and darkness on the one hand. But you also had illumination for the night. As Rashi explains, the cloud obstructed between the Jewish people and the Mitzrim behind them, so that it also blocked the light. There was illumination in front for the Jewish people, but behind the light, there was a cloud, so there was no vision, it was complete darkness for the Mitzrim who were pursuing them, which is the simplest reason, or at least part of the simplest reason, as to what on earth possessed the Egyptians to follow the Jewish people into the Yam Suf. As if to say, all things being equal, if you see that the sea has split in half, and it's either for you or for the Jewish people, you have to know at this stage that it's for the Jewish people and not for you. A positive self-image is a good thing, but delusion is quite another. And therefore, why would the Egyptians follow them into the Yam Suf? The Abarbanel and others understand the Egyptians had no notion that they're in the middle of the Yam Suf. They can't see anything. They keep moving forward. As long as they're met with dry land, as far as they're concerned, they're still on dry land. How surprised they were when the lights were turned on a few psukim later and they realize where they are. So this is the setup. You have the Jewish people. Behind them is light. Behind that is the cloud, which then puts the Egyptians, who bring up the rear, in complete darkness. Velo korab ze el ze kol halayla. Neither group could get close to one another beforehand, and this, of course, is the source of the famous drasha in the Maseches Megillah that the Malachim were not able to say Shira at that night, even when the Egyptians were drowning, even though they are Rishoyim, not at the time. And that is actually darshan from these words, Velo Karav Ze El Ze, because how is the song of the Malachim normally introduced? The Karav Ze El Ze, the Omar. Kadosh, Kadosh, etc. But on this occasion, velo karav ze el ze, kol ha-layla, that was not considered appropriate at the time. Of course, by the next morning, we were singing Az Yashir. It is ultimately something to sing about, just not at the time itself. And then the final pasuk of these three, Vayet Moshe es yado al hayam, Moshe stretches his hand out over the sea, Vayolech Hashem es hayam, Beruach Kadim azav kol halayla, Hashem moves it with the strong easterly wind, Vayasem es yam lecharava, turns the sea into dry land, Vayibaku hamayim, and the water split. There is a great deal to say about this final pasuk. We've discussed it in detail in the past. Each of these expressions, what is the meaning of an easterly wind? What does that do? How does that create a split? Why does the pasuk talk about turning the seabed into dry land before it even mentions that the water split? These are all questions that have occupied the Mefarshim. But for our purposes, in terms of having read through, these are the three prelude psukim to Kriyas Yamsuf. And it's noteworthy, and I believe this is quite well known, that these three psukim actually have relevance, practical relevance or ritual relevance, beyond Parshas Beshalach. They actually form the basis of something that we say in our tefillos at another point during the year, and that is during Hoshanos, which take place, as we know, on every day of Sukkot, either after Shacharis or after Musaf. There's two different minhagim, but we have the Hoshanos those for those 7 days. And at the end of the Hoshanos, we say, Ani Vaho Hoshiana. We call upon Hashem, and we refer to him as, we call out to him with the two terms or two names, Ani Vaho. Hoshiana, we ask him to save us. And the, according to the Mishnah, in Maseches Sukkah, this was said even as far back as the times of the Beis HaMikdash itself, when they would go around the Mizbeach. That's where the term is extracted from, the Mishnah, Ani Vaho Hoshiana. But where does it come from? Rashi in Maseches Sukkah informs us that it actually comes from the three psukim in Parshas Beshalach that we just read. How so? The first thing we note about these three psukim is that they all have exactly the same amount of letters. They all have 72 letters. Okay, so three psukim of 72 letters. But beyond that, says Rashi, the three psukim are meant to be combined. In other words, what they constitute ultimately are 72 names, each one of three letters. That means that there is a succession of names. You take one letter from the first pasuk, one letter from the second, one letter from the third, and you have your first name. And you keep going until by the time you've finished, you have 72 names. Ani, Aleph Nun Yud, and Vaho, Vav Hei Vav, are two of those 72 three-letter names. Specifically, Ani is the 37th, and Vaho is the first. Okay. The only other thing that we need to know in terms of how these names are derived is that the sequence of letters is not the same for the three verses. The first verse, Pasuk Yotes, the letters are read in order, from right to left. As the Pasuk says, Vayisa Malach, and keep on going till the end. The same is true for the third pasuk, also Vayet Moshe es yado. But when it comes to the second pasuk, in terms of forming these three-letter names, it's actually reversed. The order of the letters, the sequence, is from the end of the pasuk to the beginning. Putting all that together, if you take a look at the 37th letter of the first pasuk, 37th from the end of the second, and 37th to the third, you get Ani. And if you look at the first letter of the first pasuk, the final letter of the second, and the first of the third, you get Vaho. And that is the origins of Ani Vaho. Needless to say, one or two questions arise here. Firstly, if there's 72 names, if we may ask, why are these two specifically chosen? I mean, number one sounds like a good place to start. But number 37 is Nishtahin Nishtaher, and somehow that's like the second name. How do these become the names of choice, number 1 and number 37? It's especially interesting if we've been kind of keeping track. Ani is number 37. Vaho is number 1. So not only are they chosen specifically, but the order is reversed, which is something the Mefarshim talk about. And secondly, of the many questions, but the second one that we will deal with here, is what are we to make of the fact that the middle pasuk is read backwards? Why not read it forwards? Like the first and the third. I mean, that seems to be the intuitive way. Start at the beginning and keep going. Why does the second pasuk start at the end in terms of these names? So needless to say, there's much Sisrei Torah here, many mystical ideas, but just to have a working relationship to understand these words that we say so regularly, Ani Vaho, Hoshi Ana. So with reference to the first question, what is the yichus, what is the specific significance of the first and the 37th name particularly? This is discussed by the Vilna Gaon in his commentary to Shir HaShirim towards the beginning. And the Vilna Gaon says that actually this is reflective of an idea that we find on a number of occasions, whereby if you ever find 72 of something, the makeup will be that there is really 70. And the additional two between them represent groups of 35. That means that the core number is really 70. We call it 72 because 71 and 72 between them, those two really take the two halves of the 70 and represent them in a much more general way. If that sounds a little bit obscure, let us see an example of that. We have a notion of Shivim Umos, the 70 nations. These are the 70 core or root nations of the world. Yet we often talk about Esav, and we often talk about Yishmael, right, Golos Esav, and even Golos Yishmael in that way, certainly as significant national world entities. But Esav and Yishmael are none of the 70. The 70 nations were set at the time of Migdal Bavel. This is many years before either Yishmael or Esav were born. So they're not, where are they in the between 1 and 70? Nowhere. They're actually number 71 and 72, because between them, they now come to represent the nations. Some of them fall into the camp represented by Yishmael and some by Esav. So that is an example of how you can have 72, which is really 70 plus 2, but the additional 2 are the entire 70 between them, as we have seen. And the same is true, says the Vilna Gaon, with all of these 72s, including these three-letter names, which number 72. There's really 70, but two of them represent half each, 35 each. And now we begin to understand why the most prominent names to mention here are number 1 and number 37, because number 1 represents the first 35, which takes you from 2 to 36, and then number 37 is the second lot of 35, which will take you from 38 until 72. So this is the further clarification that we get from the Vilna Gaon as to why particularly these names. There's further discussion as to why the order of those names is reversed, 37 before number 1, but that is a discussion either for a different time, certainly not for now. But with reference to another question, or the other question that we raised, why would one of the psukim be read backwards in order to give us the name? This is discussed by Rabbeinu Bachya in our parsha. And Rabbeinu Bachya says, to understand why the middle pasuk is read backwards, we need to discuss for a moment the notion of all the letters, all the names being comprised of three letters. Because the number 3 represents the three primary attributes of Hashem. There are others also that will emanate from those three. 3 will become 9 and so on. It's a fractal of sorts. But the three primary attributes, as we know, are chesed, the attribute of kindness, and then on the other side, din, the attribute of justice, and somewhere in the middle, rachamim. These are represented by the three avos. Avram is chesed, chesed l'Avram, Yitzchak is din, gevuras Yitzchak, and pachad Yitzchak, and Yaakov is in the middle, and it has a number of names, and they all ultimately lead to the same result. Tiferes, or Emes, or Rachamim, and so on. What is the difference between the first and the third? As if to say, chesed, kindness, sounds very benign. So does Rachamim, mercy, or compassion. What is the difference between them? The difference is that Rachamim, it's somewhere in the middle. It's not exactly in the middle, but it's not as liberal as pure kindness. It's compassion, but it maintains some framework, some of the trappings of justice. And therefore, it is a blend, in a sense, which is why it's called Tiferes, the splendor of that blend of kindness and justice. But it's closer to kindness, that's for sure. No one ever tries to avoid compassion. And with this in mind, says Rabbeinu Bachya, we understand why it is that we read the first and the third psukim moving forwards and the second pasuk backwards, because it is well known that the two concepts of kindness and judgment correspond to the two sides of the right and the left. Hashem's right hand, Yemincha, is always considered to be the hand of kindness. The small, the left side, is more the side of din. And therefore, says Rabbeinu Bachya, if one is looking to pool a letter for these three-letter names from each of the psukim, where should you start? And the answer is, well, it depends what type of pasuk are you dealing with. Which attribute are you referencing here? The first pasuk refers to midas ha-chesed, which is the right side. So you start at the right side. And indeed, the numbering starts at the beginning and goes through to the left. But the second is midas ha-din, and midas ha-din emanates from the left side, and so does the letter count, and that's why you start at the end of the pasuk and go backwards. And that brings us then to the third and final verse, which, as we said, it's not pure chesed, but it's much closer to chesed than it is to din, and therefore the direction also begins at the right side and then moves to the left, and thus we understand how the directions of the various psukim are the way that they are. So that is something, I would say, of a working introduction to the terms ani v'ho, all of which are sourced in the three psukim in our parsha. The question that remains, which we are entitled to ask specifically in Parshas Beshalach, is why is a practice on Sukkos, the practice, the custom of Hoshanas, what's it got to do with psukim in Kriyas Yamsuf? Kriyas Yamsuf didn't happen on Sukkos. Last we checked, it happened on Pesach. But the psukim which give us these names find expression in the festival of Sukkos. What is behind that? Ma inyan Kriyas Yamsuf etzel chagas Sukkos? And this question is discussed in the drushes of Reb Shlomo Fischer, Zatzal, and he explains, there is an aspect of Sukkos, which perhaps we mention it whenever we can, but I don't know that it is as well known as one would think it should be. Chag HaSukkos is a celebration of the entry of the Jewish people into the land of Israel. This is the progression of the Shalosh Regalim. Pesach is leaving Mitzrayim, the birth of a nation. Shavuos is the giving of the Torah, and Sukkos brings it all together with the Anani HaKovod, leading to the entry into Eretz Yisrael. And it's for this reason that so much of Sukkos surrounds or revolves around the idea of water. We take the Arba Minim, the Esrog, is called Hadar, Hadar Pneimayim, it needs a lot of water. Arve Nachal, the Aravos, are by flowing water, says the Abarbanel. All of this is to give thanks to Hashem for bringing us from the Midbar, where there is no natural water at all, to the land of Israel. We still need rain, and you have to daven for it, but you've moved into a place of water. The water represents the entry into Eretz Canaan. So much so, says the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim, that the two mitzvahs of Sukkah and Arba Minim on Sukkos are the before and after. We remember how we initially sat in Sukkos, and then were taken from there to Eretz Yisrael. And it's interesting just to come back to Hoshanas for a moment to see how this is reflected. Every day, we circle the Bima once, and then an Hoshana Rabbah seven times. Where is that from? What does that reflect? What does that correspond to? It's the pattern of how we conquered Jericho, that say the Mefarshim, that Yerushalmi, I believe even. As if to say, because Sukkos is a celebration of our entry into Eretz Yisrael, so one of the primary customs reflects the way that we conquered the first city there, of Yericho. So much so, the Vilna Gaon says in his Perush on the Shulchan Aruch, that every day in Hoshana, when we do Hoshanas, the Sefer Torah is taken out. But then on Hoshana Rabbah, we take out more than one Sefer Torah. Well, how many do we take out? And here there's two minhagim. The one minhag is, as many as you have, some shuls are blessed with many Sifrei Torah. But there is a minhag that we take out seven Sifrei Torah. Even if there's more, you take out seven. And one is brought back to the Aron after each of the Hoshanas. Says the Vilna Gaon, why do we take out seven Sifrei Torah and Hoshana Rabbah? It's a zecher for the seven shofaros that were sounded on the seventh day when they encircled Yericho seven times. Somehow, and that itself is a fascinating point to ponder, why the shofar, why the Sefer Torah takes the place of a shofar. We don't blow the shofar, obviously, on Hoshana Rabbah, but at a certain point, the Torah is calling to us as much as the shofar did. So all of this has the entry of Eretz Canaan is indelibly bound up with Chag HaSukkos. And with that in mind, says Reb Shlomo Fischer, let us ask the question, what was the very first step that we took towards Eretz Canaan? That is to say, not directionally, but what was the very first act that happened that paved the way for us to enter the land? The answer is Kriyas Yamsuf. And we refer to it in Az Yashir, when we say, Namogu Koyoshve Canaan, Tipol Aleim Masa B'Fachad, the residents of Canaan, they melted and they became afraid. This was the first salvo on the existing population of Eretz Canaan to instill fear into them. And this fear persisted, as we know, in the Haftarah for Parsha Shelach, which is taken from early on in Yeshua, Perek Beis, I believe, when they come to Rachav, and Rachav says people are still afraid. You should know they are afraid of the Jewish people because of what happened, and she makes specific reference to Kriyas Yamsuf. So the very first shake-up of Canaan's population is Kriyas Yamsuf. Therefore, says Reb Shlomo Fischer, we can now understand why it is that on Sukkos, when we celebrate our entry into Eretz Yisrael, we make reference to where it all began. Kriyas Yamsuf. These three psukim, which initiated the splitting of the Red Sea, which was the first preparing of the ground for our conquest of Eretz Canaan, finds expression every day on Chag HaSukkos. That's how the two are connected. And it's interesting how experientially they're connected also. Because we left Mitzrayim on that seventh day, the sea split for us. And that is exactly what would happen if we link in 40 years later, the Yarden splits. There's other ways to cross the Yarden. Most people have done it without it splitting. But it's almost like a redoing of Kriyas Yamsuf just as we enter Eretz Canaan itself. These are the wonderful comments of Reb Shlomo Fischer. And I believe there's room to continue this idea just for a moment or two, because there are many other points of similarity and parallel between the events of Kriyas Yamsuf and Chag HaSukkos. beyond Anivaho. Firstly, the Torah tells us that we sit in Sukkos to remember that we said that Basukkos Hashavti, that Hashem put us in Sukkos when we were in Eretz, when we were in the wilderness. And as we know, there's a Machlokus, Rabbi Lezer, and Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Lezer says, and the Shulchan Aruch cites this as the halacha, that it's to commemorate the Anani HaKavod. And what is the role of the Anani HaKavod? What is their function? They protect the Jewish people. They protect them from the heat, from the elements. They protect them from natural hazards, from their enemies. So Sukkos is a celebration of the protection of Hashem, which is reflected by the Anani HaKavod. When was the first time the Anani HaKavod afforded protection for the Jewish people? It's in Kriyas Yamsuf. It's in the pasuk that we just read, where the cloud that went from being before them moves to behind them. To what end? Rashi says, citing the Medrash, because the Egyptians, they didn't know exactly where they're going, but they know that the Jews are in front of them, and they started launching arrows and missiles, and the cloud absorbed all of those and protected the Jewish people. The very first experience of being protected by the Anani HaKavod took place at Kriyas Yamsuf. And that becomes a point of celebration for Chag HaSukkos much later on. Another key element within Sukkos is that of Hidur Mitzvah, as we know. Anyone who's ever going to invest in Hidur Mitzvah knows the place to start is with the Esrog, pre-Eitz Hadar. It literally has Hidur written into its mitzvahs. And Hidur Mitzvah is a very pronounced idea within the mitzvahs of Sukkah. It's very interesting to note that the first, or in fact, the quintessential expression of Hidur Mitzvah in the Pasuk is derived from Az Yashir. As the Pasuk says, Shabbos Kuflam and Gimel, on the word Ze Keli Va'anvehu, this is my God, I will glorify him, says the Gemara, Hisno Elefanav B'mitzvahs. Adorn yourself before him in mitzvahs. So Hidur Mitzvah, which is such a hallmark of Chag HaSukkos, also has its roots in Kriyas Yamsuf. The Jewish people saw what a miracle Hashem had laid on for them. The miracle was a Mehudar miracle, with all of those other things, and there was fresh water for them if they needed it, and it was deluxe. It wasn't just to save them, it was Behidur. So they respond by saying, well, maybe we should do our mitzvahs Behidur. And that, once again, lands so prominently in Chag HaSukkos. Sukkos is also known as a time of judgment over water, for the rainfall specifically. The very first time the Jewish people, as a people, were judged with regarding water was at the time of Kriyas Yamsuf, when the question is, should the water split for them? As we know, the Medrash tells us, the Satan comes and accuses them, halala of the Avodah Zarah, halala of the Avodah Zarah. What's the difference between the Jewish people and the Egyptians? Until Hashem demonstrates the difference between them. But the first time we stood ever in judgment as a people regarding water was Kriyas Yamsuf, and we were acquitted and vindicated, and this once more finds expression in Sukkos as Bechag Nidonim Al Hamayim. And there is one final point of connection, and all of these really come together, and I mention them as elaborations on Rav Shlomo Fischer's point, who really opened up the discussion. The watchword, so to speak, where we recall Anivaho, are the Hoshanos. I mean, that's the expression that comes out the whole time, Hoshana, Hoshana. There's many words in Lashon HaKodesh for saving. And interestingly, especially when it comes to Pesach, we know that there's the Arba Lashonos of Geula, which we spoke about just a couple of weeks ago. And there's the Hotesi, and the Hitzalti, and the Ga'alti, and the Lakachti. And those are the primary four expressions, of course, Vehevesi into the land of Israel. But you never find the Hoshati. That word is never used for Hashem saving the Jewish people. It's a word for saving, but apparently it's not relevant to Yetzias Mitzrayim. There is another term, important to note, of saving or redeeming, that also features with regards to Yetzias Mitzrayim, but not before Chumash Devarim. And that is the concept of pidyon, redemption. Al gu'ulaseinu v'al pidus nafshenu. We say it in the tefillah, but it's very interesting. I think it's mentioned 6 times in the Chumash, and all of them are in Chumash Devarim. Not before. Either way. So now we have all of our expressions. Benovo shati. There's only one place in the Torah where it describes Hashem saving the Jewish people with the word, with the concept of Yeshua. And that's Kriyas Yamsuf. Vayosha Hashem Bayom Ahu Es Yisrael Miyad Mitzrayim is the introduction to Oz Yashir and the description of Kriyas Yamsuf. And these, I believe, are certainly points well worthy of reflection to see just on how many different levels, linguistically, thematically, there's so much commonality between Kriyas Yamsuf and Chag HaSukkos, and it all begins with Ani Vaho Hoshiyan. Just one final comment, moving away from the Sukkos Kriyas Yamsuf connection, a final comment on this pasuk that the Malach went from before them and stood behind them. This is the first time we've had any reference to the Malach, which is interesting because we're seeing it described, we're seeing him described as acting, but we were never introduced to him as doing anything else. Last we heard Hashem goes before them with the pillar of cloud, with the pillar of fire. There's no reference to a Malach. And then the first we hear of a Malach being in front of them is when he moves to go behind them. Who is this Malach? And of course, Mefarshim discuss it, but there is a stunning explanation of the Meshech Chochma on this Pasuk. And it begins with Hashem's command to Moshe, which is Shlishi, Perik Yudalet Pasuk Tesvav. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Perik Yudalet Pasuk Tesvav. Hashem says to Moshe, Matitzak Eli, why are you crying out to me? Interestingly, the Pasuk doesn't tell us that Moshe was crying out. We infer from Hashem says, why are you crying out to me? It's also interesting that the two Pesukim earlier, Yud Gimel and Yud Dalet, Moshe says to the Jewish people, don't be afraid. Everything will be fine. And the next thing we hear, Hashem is saying to Moshe, why are you crying out to me? So that's interesting. Maybe part of why Moshe says that everything will be okay is because he's going to daven to Hashem. He tells the Jewish people to be silent, but he's not silent. But Hashem says to him, no need to pray anymore. Daber el b'nei Yisrael v'yisrael. So speak to the Jewish people and they will go forward. What's the significance of this pasuk? Daber el b'nei Yisrael v'yisrael. There's such an important thing is happening here. Moshe is the leader of the Jewish people. And as their leader, naturally, he will go first, wherever they go. That's entirely reasonable. But that's the significance of what Hashem is saying to Moshe here. I don't want you to daven at this stage. I want you to do something else. Daber al b'nei Yisrael v'yisrael. Speak to the Jewish people. Let them travel forward. Where else will they travel? Backwards? What's the point? Let them travel forward even though you will not be in front of them. You're not leading them. This is a first for the Jewish people. If Moshe goes before them, they are very confident that whatever happens, nothing will stand in Moshe's way. But what if Moshe isn't going in front of them on this occasion? He's holding back and telling them to move forward. How do they feel? Less confident. And what's the significance of this? Says the Meshech Chochma. Miracles, as much as they are supernatural in terms of the way we would or could not explain them, but they have their own tributaries. They have their own fuel. They have their own basis. It's merit. And different merits will lead to different miracles. What is the merit that leads to the miracle of Kriyas Yamsuf? Says Meshech Chochma, it's emuna. It's the Jewish people's faith. Their faith in Hashem that he will save them. If that's in place, that is what will split the Red Sea. But because it is the merit of emuna that will be the catalyst or the trigger for this miracle, their emunah needs to be 100%. And what does that entail? Moshe is out of the picture. As long as Moshe is before them, their emunah in Hashem is, in a sense, one could say, buttressed or supported or corroborated by the fact, if Moshe is going forward, I'm pretty sure that we'll be okay. So now Moshe goes behind them. And now it's just the Jewish people and their emunah. That's the level of emunah they need in order to split the Yam Suf. And indeed, that's what happened. Nachshon went first into the sea, not Moshe. It's an amazing way of looking at the inner dynamics, so to speak, of the miracle of Kriyas Yam Suf. It's provided by the Jewish people through their emunah. But if it's going to be provided by emunah, it's got to be emunah first class. Moshe's out of the picture. And this, as Meshech Chochma, is what is being denoted and described by Pasuk Yotes, which says the Malach that was until that point going before them moved to behind them. And we asked, who's the Malach? Says Meshech Chochma, Moshe Rabbeinu is the Malach. The Nevi'im are called Malachim in the Navi. And even in the Chumash, actually, in Parshas Chukas, when the Jewish people say, Vayishlach Malach, Vayotzienu Mitzrayim, Hashem sent a Malach and took us out of Mitzrayim, says Rashi, that's Moshe, invoking this idea. Malach, we normally translate as angel, but a Malach comes from the word Malacha. Malacha is a task or a mission, and anyone who is fully dedicated and devoted to that mission is called a Malach. And this then is Pasuk Yotes. The Malach Moshe, who would until this point go before them, he went behind them. And now it's just them, and they rose to the occasion, moving forward, and thus did the Yam Suf split. This is reminiscent of a parallel comment of the Meshech Chochma in the Haftarah for Parshas Vayera, where we have the episode of the Isha Shunamis, where her son, as we read, and it's in the Haftarah, tragically died. She comes to Elisha, and in the end, Elisha performs a miracle and brings the boy back to life. But what's very significant is, when she comes to Elisha, Elisha doesn't know why. It's explicit in the psukim. He says, Hashem helimli, velo igidli. Hashem is not telling me what's happening with this woman. It's not normal for her to come on a day like this. Something is happening and I don't know what it is. And Hashem is not telling me. And when he says to the woman, is everything okay? She just says, shalom, and he follows her and finds it. What's the significance of Elisha not knowing why the woman is visiting him? Because here too, says Meshech Chochma, the zchus that powered, or that fueled the miracle of Tchias HaMesim, of her son coming back to life, was her emuna. That's where it came from. But because, once again, if it's coming for emunah, it's got to be pure emunah. It's very easy to trust the Navi when he knows why you're there, even before you've said anything. But imagine, you come to the Navi, and you believe that he is the instrument through which Hashem will perform a miracle for your child, and he doesn't even know why you're there. And to persist in the emunah, I don't know why he doesn't know, it doesn't make a difference, he's a Navi, nothing has changed. That raised the level of emunah as it was expressed enough to be able to bring about that miracle. So these are really, one can see the resonance of what the Meshech Chochma describes in our Parsha about the Jewish people. Emunah when things don't seem to be working the way you'd expect them to, and similarly with the Isha Shunamis in the Haftarah there. Within Az Yashir itself, as we move just a bit deeper, well, into the Parsha, and we get to Az Yashir, and if we would describe it even generally, we would say that it begins with being saved from the Mitzrim, of course, Az Yivizim Raska, Ayhil Lishua, etc. But at a certain point, it moves towards Eretz Yisrael. The final psukim to be Eimo, Vesita Eimo, Nehalta Va'ozacha. So in other words, two-thirds of the Shira, one could say, are about salvation from the Mitzrim. And the final third is about heading towards Eretz Canaan. Very fitting for Shlomo Fischer that it should end with matters of Eretz Yisrael, especially in terms of the Kriyas Yamsuf, as we described before. Now, this is not the first time that the land of Israel, or Eretz Canaan, has been discussed with reference to the Jewish people leaving Mitzrayim. The very first time Hashem appears to Moshe about Yetzias Mitzrayim, he mentions the land of Israel. This is by the burning bush, Shmos Perek Gimel. Hashem says, I will go and take them out of Mitzrayim. I will bring them up, El Eretz Tova, El Eretz Zavas Chalav Udavash. I will take them to the land of Israel. And moreover, in the beginning of Parshas Va'era, it is the fifth of the four expansions of Geula, is Ve'hevesi. So Hashem again says, I will take them and redeem them, take them to me, and then I will bring them to the land. So the land of Israel, as where the Jewish people are headed towards, has been mentioned already in Parshas Shmos and the beginning of Va'era. And then it goes into hiatus a little bit, as leaving Mitzrayim becomes the order of the day. And it would appear that once we have finally and decisively been redeemed from the Egyptians, so Eretz Yisrael is back on the map. That would be a synopsis, as if to say, originally was part of the discussion, it then faded as we were leaving, but now reappears as we have been fully redeemed, and that is where we are headed. But Reb Leib Mintzberg, that's all, in the Ben Melech, draws our attention to the fact that the land of Israel has not returned in the way that it was being discussed before. It has actually returned to be discussed in a higher way than it was originally. After all, consider again, as we recall those early psukim, Hashem says, I will take the Jewish people up from Mitzrayim to Eretz Zavas Chalav Udavash, a land flowing with milk and honey. These are superlative properties of Eretz Yisrael, to be sure. Va'ired la'tzilom yad Mitzrayim, ula'alosom el Eretz Tova Rechava, Eretz Zavas Chalav Udavash. It's described more in terms of the goodness of the land, its bounty, and so on. In Oz Yashir, it's not spoken about as Eretz Zavas Chalav Udavash. In fact, it's fair to say that the land is not even spoken about as a land at all, by which we mean, let us come to the relevant psukim, which is Pasuk Yud Zayin. Or even as early as Yud Gimel, Nachisa v'chastech amzuka alta, the nation that you redeemed, you've led them. Nehalt of Azcha el nevei kodshecha. The first reference of where the Jewish people are headed towards is called nevei kodshecha. Nevei kodshecha is your holy abode. That means that we don't yet talk about the land of Israel as the place where the Jewish people will be living. It's the place where Hashem lives. We normally associate that with the Beis HaMikdash, I think. Okay. And further in Pasuk Yud Zayin, to the Emo, Vesita Emo, you'll bring them, Bahar Nachlascha, to the mountain of your inheritance, Machon L'Shivtecha, Ba'alta, place where you will dwell, Mikdash Hashem Konenu Yadecha. So this is very significant, because the place where the Jewish people are headed towards is this country is no longer discussed in terms of Eretz Zavas Chalav Udavash. It's not even discussed as a country, but more Hashem's abode with absolute focus, near total focus on Hashem's mountain and the Beis HaMikdash and so on. What is the meaning of all of this? Says Reb Leib Mintzberg, there are two things that are true about the land of Israel. Number one, it's a good land. It's Eretz Zavas Chalav Udavash. It has these wonderful properties, as the Torah says, Eretz Tova Urchava, all good things. Another thing that's true is that It's a place where the Shekhinah resides. Naturally, the place where Hashem resides, so to speak. But that's what the pasuk says. And both are true. And they go together. They're not a contradiction to each other. It is the best place in all senses of the word. Both in terms of physical bounty and in terms of spiritual focus and the divine presence there. The question is, what is the Jewish people's relationship to the land of Israel? And here we see something of a graduation. As if to say, when Hashem originally appears to Moshe about taking the Jewish people to the land of Israel, they're not yet at a state where they can relate to it and appreciate why that's where they should be going, because that's where the divine presence dwells. As far as the Jewish people is concerned, they're in a terrible matzav. It's called servitude and oppression. If you tell them they'll be headed to a good situation, which is called the land of plenty, and tova rechava, land filled with milk and honey, that is a perfect piece of good news for the Jewish people as they are at that time. But since that time, so much had changed. So much had changed within the Jewish people. And they graduated. They've elevated. In the intervening year, they've come to encounter and experience the divine presence on a daily basis, through the miracles, through the makos, and through the divine supervision. It's a year of miracles for them. And that's already begins their education and their induction and orientation towards Hashem. And when we left Mitzrayim, we connected with Hashem. We entered a bris, a covenant with Hashem. And we became connected to Hashem. As we say, Hashem took us out. Lo aydei malach, lo aydei saraf, Hashem directly, because it was an absolute connection between us and Hashem. We've come to see things differently. And never more so than the events of the splitting of the Red Sea. We often think that we pass through the Red Sea on the way to Revelation, and that revelation would take place at Har Sinai, which of course it did. But it's a mistake to think that there was no revelation until that point. Do we not say, Ze keli v'anvehu? Rashi famously says, a shifcha, even a maidservant, she saw and has an apprehension of the Shekhinah, Ra'as HaShekhinah layam, what other Nevi'im did not see. So it's been a time of revelation, and once there's revelation, so then there is reorientation. And the Jewish people have finally adopted an affinity for the divine. So that when their sights are set on this elevated time, which is a time to aspire to, when their sights are set towards where they're going, how would you describe it? Do you describe it as a land flowing with milk and honey? It is. But is that the primary description? Let's move to the side. And now, what is there to say primarily about the land of Israel? It's where the divine presence resides. That's where we're headed. We're a better place to be. So as we say, the land of Israel has returned on the map, having faded for a while. But it's a new map. And it has new qualities now that are being emphasized. And indeed, it's for this reason that the reference to heading towards Eretz Canaan is in Az Yashir. What's this got to do with the splitting of the Red Sea? Regardless of where you're going, that needed to happen, otherwise you wouldn't be going anywhere. So why is this the culminating part of the Az Yashir? Because this vision of the land of Israel is also a product of the miracle of the splitting of the Red Sea. Ze keli v'anvehu. So wonderful words from Reb Leib Mintzberg with regards to the finale, the final movement, as we say, of the symphony of Az Yashir. Let's just conclude with a very interesting discussion that relates to a place called Mara, which is where we went in Perek Tesvav. And what do we know about Mara? Well, the waters were bitter. And Perek Tes Vav, Pasuk Kaf Gimel, Vayavo Marasa, who came to Mara, Vlo Yochlu Lishtas Mayim Mimara, they couldn't drink from there. Kimara means the waters were bitter. Whereas the Baal Shem Tov used to say, Kimarim Haim, there's two plural nouns in the Pasuk, the Jewish people and the water. They couldn't drink the water, Kimarim Haim, because they were bitter. The Jewish people were bitter. Says the Baal Shem Tov, water has no taste, but if you're bitter, water tastes bitter. Often a person projects taste onto the outside, certainly not pshat, but as is always the case, as my father Zatzal used to say, Hasidic forces are not meant to be pshat, but they're always emes. So they called the place Mara, and they complained to Moshe, Vayilonu ha'amal Moshe limor, manishtem, Vayitzak al Hashem, Moshe cries out to Hashem, Vayawayu Hashem eitz, Hashem shows him a wood, Vayishlech al ha'mayim, he throws it into the water, Vayimtiku ha'mayim, and the water became sweet, that is to say, drinkable. Sham sam lo chok u'mishpat, it is there that Hashem provided for the Jewish people, chok, a statute, and mishpat, and laws, v'sham nisahu, and tested them there. What are the chok and the mishpat that Hashem provided for the Jewish people? Says Rashi, chok u'mishpat, Nathan lehem mitzvot parshiyos shel Torah. Hashem gave them a few sections of the Torah. She is asked by him to involve themselves in them. Shabbos, Parah Aduma, and Dinim. Shabbos, okay, which means this Shabbos is already from Mara, even though it's in Aseres Hadibros, but as Mefarshim point out, in Aseres Hadibros we're commanded to keep it. In Mara, we're commanded already to start learning about it. Rashi says, she is asku bahen, to be osik in the Parshios. And Rashi also mentions Parah Aduma, which is very interesting. Also, it's not yet practical. You need an Ohel Moed in order to do the Parah Aduma, but already to be osik in Parah Aduma. So says Rashi, and this is also borne out by the Yotzros in Parshas Parah, coming up quite soon to the Arba Parshios, and they have Yotzros, special additional prayers attached. Some people say them, some people don't say them, but whether or not you say them, they're still there. And they are dating back to early, again, commentators, contemporaries of Rashi, if not some earlier, some later. And in the Piyut, for one of the Yotzros for Parshas Parah, it says, Mimara Chuka Gozar. The Chokah, the statute of Parah Aduma, was already decreed from Mara, as Rashi says. Mefarshim point out that the classic, the sources that we normally look to discuss these things in Chazal, mention other mitzvahs but not Parah Aduma. The Gemara talks about Mara, about the Chok and Mishpat. So does the Mechilta, and they mention Shabbos and Kibud Ava'im, but not Parah Aduma. And as is pointed out by those that have looked through all of the Mefarshim, the Rav Kasher in the Torah Shlema, who of course had all the Midrashim were open before him, says that the source of Rashi is in Seder Olam Zuta, which again is an ancient collection of Midrashim, and that's Parah Aduma. We may ask, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, why would the Gemara not talk about it? Why does the Gemara mention other things? Shabbos and Kibud Ava'im. Why not mention Parah Aduma? Why is it only in the other Midrash? But says Rabbi Yaakov, the reason is because Rashi has told us that the parshas that were given here were she'is asku bahen, in order to be learning the parshas. Parah Aduma is one of them. The Gemara in Sanhedrin is talking about certain elements of the mitzvahs that were already practicable. Not all of them, not in totality, but there were already some aspects of Shabbos they could already keep. So the sukya of the Gemara in Sanhedrin about Mara is about which mitzvahs were given to them that they could already keep practically. It's dealing there, if one looks there, one will see. Rashi is dealing with the mitzvahs they were to learn about. So this is now Parah Aduma. It is in place to mention, because it is mentioned by a number of people, the Torah Tamima was also quite perplexed by why would Rashi would say Parah Aduma, the Gemara didn't talk about it, and the Mechilta didn't talk about it. We assume the Torah Tamima didn't have access to the Sifrei Zuta, I don't know. And the Torah Tamima famously suggests that the reason why we our reading of Rashi as Parah Aduma is based on an erroneous opening of Rosh HaTevus. He suggests, as the Gemara says, that what was given to us in Mara was Shabbos and Kibud Av. And when Rashi copied it, so Shabbos is Shabbos, Kibud Av, in the versions of Rashi, was shortened to Kaf Aleph for Kibud Av. But then Kaf Aleph, with time, the Kaf looked a bit like a Pei, till someone opened it up as Parah Aduma. Some community-minded person who wanted to make life easier for the Jewish people, shouldn't be Rosh HaTevus, we've had enough to deal with, and therefore he opened up Pei Aleph. Kibud Ein became Kaf Aleph, Kaf Aleph became Pei Aleph, Pei Aleph became Parah Aduma. This is the suggestion of the Torah Tamima. However, Rav Kasher and others, but Rav Kasher in the Torah Shalema in the Miluim to our Parsha, says that that's not possible to say that that's why Rashi reads Parah Aduma, because later on, in the end of Parshas Mishpatim, we will see Rashi again will refer to Parah Aduma in Perek Kaf Dalet Pasuk Gimel, where it says that Moshe came as a prelude to receiving the Torah. He told them all Hashem's words, Eskola Mishpatim, and Rashi says, what's Kola Mishpatim? Sheva Mrs. B'nai Noach, V'Shabbos, V'Kibud Av V'Eim, U'Parah Aduma V'Dinim. So Rashi there mentions Kibud Av V'Eim and Parah Aduma side by side, which means that when he wants to talk about Kibud Av V'Eim, he'll call it that, and if he talks about Parah Aduma, he'll call it that, and if he wants to talk about both of them, he'll talk about both of them, but one didn't become the other. So this is the famous Kasha of Kasha in the Torah Shalema. Either way, so, but as has been pointed out, the source is the Sifri Zuta. The question that emerges, and with this we'll conclude, is why, of all mitzvahs, Parah Aduma, I mean, Shabbos already is relevant to them. Parah Aduma will not be relevant until they have a Mishkan. Why is it inappropriate of all the mitzvahs to Parah Aduma? Doesn't seem to be such a likely candidate. And this question is raised by the Tosfos in the collection Moshav Zakenim. And Tosfos say, the reason why Parah Aduma is introduced to the Jewish people now is because it has an aspect to it which is significant and unusual. It's a contradiction. It makes some people tamei, other people tahor, right? Mitameis hataharim, mitaris hatameim. It doesn't move in the way that you think it would, as if to say, let it be a force for tahara or for tumah. But the very thing that's mitamei is also mitahir. It's difficult to relate to. And if it is a chok, but Hashem made it easier for the Jewish people to relate to. Why or how? By presenting the idea to them at a time where they had just experienced such a thing, where the water was bitter, and Hashem took a piece of wood. A piece of wood is itself bitter. Certainly the Medrash makes a point of saying, mar mamtik es hamar. So something which is bitter, which we should think, or should only make things more bitter, and it made the water sweet. Go figure. But that's a reality, and the Jewish people then had water to drink. This is a time where they'll be most receptive to the idea of, to the mitzvah of Parah Aduma. It will resonate with an experience that they've just had. Wonderful explanation of the Tosas. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says, and with this we'll conclude, that Moshe is preparing the Jewish people for Matan Torah. Mara is already just a few weeks before Matan Torah. And one of the things you need to know about Matan Torah is there's a lot more to it than human intellect. You're meant to apply your intellect, but the subtotal of the substance and the wisdom of Torah doesn't stop when human intellect stops. Human intellect is limited. Torah is Hashem's wisdom, it's unlimited. And not everything could be accounted for with the way that we would normally logically perceive. What is the classic, of course, way to give an orientation again towards Matan Torah? Parah Aduma. It's the quintessential chok, with its contradictions and its opaque nature, it's inexplicable. And indeed, Parah Aduma is called Chukas HaTorah. It's not even called Chukas HaParah, as the Rechaim HaKadosh points out in Parshas Chukas. It's called Chukas HaTorah, because it's a chok that basically, it tells you a lot about the entire Torah, and that's something you need to know. The moral of the story is not that a person should not engage with his intellect fully to the best of his ability, but to realize how much more there is in the vast totality of the infinite sea of Torah, which incorporates human intellect, goes way, way beyond. That's important to establish with the Jewish people before they come to receive the Torah. And indeed, we said, Na'aseh v'nishma. Na'aseh v'nishma means we prepare to do it even before hearing it, because who's to say that if we hear it, it's going to make a difference? We already understand that there are certain things that cannot be accounted for by human intellect, but Hashem's credit is good by the Jewish people, and our finest hour came through with Na'aseh v'nishma. We'll leave it over there for this evening. Everyone should have a good week, and we should all have Besoros Tovos, Leklal, Prat. All the best.